This is Counter Stories, a podcast by people of color, for people of color, and everyone else. I'm Anthony Galloway, senior partner at Dendros Group and executive director of Arts Us.
Luz Maria Frias, founder and CEO of The Savvy Coach, where we provide executive coaching and race equity training.
Don Eubanks, associate professor at Metropolitan State University and cultural consultant.
And I'm Marianne Combs. I'm a reporter and producer at NPR News.
So I know there's lots of things for us to talk about. One of the things that we have is, as we've been preparing for today, we've come to the realization that even though COVID has changed much of our lives and routines as people of color, unfortunately, we can still experience the constant drone of racism, both overt and systemic, that still continue to plague us, from Ahmaud Arbery to incidents in our daily lives, on trains, between communities of colors, the inequities that exist in our health system. Unfortunately, we are continuing to experience the same systemic forces. We are going to dive into this and show the pattern that persists, even though our routines are severely disrupted. And so I'm going to pass to Luz. Luz, I know you've heard these stories, but we are, unfortunately, as we have in the past here on Counter Stories, having to yet again discuss and deal with another unarmed death of a Black man. So I'm going to pass over to you, Luz. Can you give us a little bit of background about not only Ahmaud Arbery, but then some of the other experiences that have gone on recently?
So with Ahmaud Arbery, many folks may have heard, he was shot and killed on February 23rd of 2020. He was jogging through his neighborhood where two armed white men stalked him and killed him, and they filmed it. I have to say that when the social media first came up with his video, and that would have been just last month in April, so it took 2 months for that to come to bear, I myself could not watch the video. I asked myself why, and a number of reasons came up. One is the trauma of having to witness that, stalking and killing this young man, 25-year-old man, jogging in his neighborhood, was too much for me from a processing trauma point of view. And we know about racial battle fatigue is something that Dr. William Smith in 2003 diagnosed as something that's happening within our communities of color with trauma. There's also the case of Breonna Taylor, who is a young woman from Louisville, Kentucky, an EMT. As an essential worker, she had been working at two hospitals on March 13th of 2020 when she was shot and killed at home. So with Breonna Taylor, yet a name that we haven't seen on national scale yet, she is laying in her bed with her partner at night. Police barge into their apartment unannounced to serve a warrant. It should be noted here that the warrant was for a different address. So they were at the wrong address to begin with. Neighbors have given statements to police that there was no warning, no knocking at the door, announcing themselves as police. Breonna Taylor, as she lay next to her partner, they thought they were being burglarized. He owned a weapon in his home, so it was licensed to carry. As he thought he was being burglarized, then he thought about self-defense. And in the process, police started shooting, and he shot in return. 20 shots were fired by police. Both Breonna Taylor and her partner then were killed. These are the stories that just really ramp up the trauma in our communities of color, indigenous communities. These are terrorizing activities. And there's this vicarious trauma. When I'm talking to my friends, well, did you know them? My immediate response is, I don't need to know them to care about them as a human being. I see their humanity from the start. These are the things that are going through my mind right now as we're dealing with COVID-19 and how we see it disparately impacting, medically speaking, our communities of color and our indigenous communities.
We don't even have to go out of state, because we had an experience here in Minnesota where Douglas Lewis was killed by a Watertown resident named Anthony Trifoletti after a minor accident, according to the Spokesman Recorder. Now, Trifoletti was licensed to carry a firearm, as many of us are in our community, and yet, here again, something that should have been handled in a human way, someone who isn't, and someone who feels like they're endangered in their own way, takes out a firearm and shoots somebody else. This is another unnecessary death. And the thing that I can't wrap my head around is that it doesn't matter how you act. You're told that you have the right to defend yourself and it's venerated in country songs and I'm going to do what's necessary to protect my life unless you're Black. Now, if you're Black, the rules constantly change. And no matter what your response is, it's the wrong one. And now I'm having to yet again communicate the way the world is to my children. And I'm running out of answers and I'm running out of options that still keep them whole.
I think for me, the hardest part is hearing people try to justify these killings, right? To say, oh, well, there were robberies. Therefore, we have the right to shoot and kill a man who refused to stop and answer us. Although we're not police, we don't have any authority to stop somebody jogging in the neighborhood. But because he refused to stop, obviously he was guilty. I think people are conflicted in how to respond. A lot of people are saying they don't want to accept racism. They refuse to accept it as a racist act. And so then they try to justify, you know, the actions of the men who killed him. But when people of color do it, there's all of a sudden, well, there's something wrong with that community. And that's why those people are killing other people or inciting violence on other people. Obviously, there's something wrong with their community. But when white people do it, all of a sudden, there's this justification, right? We need to justify why they did this. He went into a house that was under construction, so he shouldn't have done that. Does that mean that he should be killed in the street in the middle of the day? No, but they try to find these reasons. And this is what I'm seeing on social media when just from comments, right? And people trying to have this discussion or people trying to justify this killing and saying, even the guy who released the video who was driving in a separate truck, I also didn't watch the video. I cannot put myself through that. I refuse to watch the video. But his comment was he released the video because he thought it would justify the killing. And that in itself is saying something about our society.
Yeah. Haleigh, to your point, there in fact was a white gentleman about Ahmad's age, you know, mid-20s from what we could tell. But within a week of Ahmaud Arbery's video going viral, he decided to go jogging, holding a flat screen TV, running for the 2.23 miles, hoping to see if he would be approached by anybody for believing that he was a suspected robber, right? A thief. And no one stopped him. And he films this video saying, look at this. Here I am physically running with this television down a street, which should raise red flags to everybody in the neighborhood, right? Yet no one even bothered to stop him or report him to police. And his video went viral from the standpoint of, look, this is a race issue. Here you have Ahmaud Arbery jogging. He is in jogging clothing, not carrying anything in his own neighborhood and being accosted for being a thief. Yet you have this white jogger attempting to replicate the scenario, making it worse with an LCD TV. Who runs with the TV unless you have something that, you know, you're trying to get away from as a thief? And yet there was no repercussions to him. So to your point, Haleigh, you know, there are some good examples out there of folks trying to replicate and trying to lift up the point that it is race.
And with social media, too, you know, there's a video of a UPS driver who's approached by a woman saying, there's been robberies in this neighborhood, and I just want to confirm that you are who you are. And he's got his uniform on, he's driving his truck, and she's saying, give me your supervisor's name because I want them to send a different driver. And so he's got this all on video. And she is so, so sure that she is right. She's so sure, and she's saying it's not a race thing. It's because there's robberies. And he's a Black man. There's packages in his car of, like, addresses in that neighborhood. So there's, like, you know, a lot of people think that this is new or something. It's not. It's just that we're seeing it more because people, like those kids on the light rail station who kicked that old lady in the face, people take video of it, and they think it's hilarious or they think it's going to vindicate them or they think it's going to justify what they're doing. it's making white people so uncomfortable that they're trying to justify everything, like I was saying earlier, right? And so now that we have all these videos and all the cell phone footage of all these racist acts happening, and yet we don't have the footage from the raid on the woman who was killed in the middle of the night with her husband from the police.
I'd like to talk a little bit about what you were saying earlier, Luz, about the trauma of witnessing these videos and just the strangeness that, and the sad truth that those videos are what gets the attention to the case, but it requires so many people reliving trauma in order for it to come to the light of other people who are not aware of it and who are the ones, you know, who actually have to be affected by it for it to change the white majority. But it actually, we saw this play out in the Vietnam War, you know, how we document bodies coming home, how we document the way soldiers are killed has a huge influence on whether the United States, you know, the mass majority supports a war or not. If they don't see the bodies, they're much more likely to continue supporting the war than if they see the young people whose lives have been destroyed. So there's all this cleaning up of messaging that happens, but the truth is so much more traumatic than that. And people have to witness the trauma in order to understand the gravity of the situation.
And I agree with you, Marianne, because what's underlying that, I think, was until that video was released, we as a society, as a community, were not aware of the systemic racism that was involved that allowed those two individuals, those two white men, and they were a father and his son, to go uncharged for 2 months. I mean, the fact that one of these guys was an ex-police officer on a force somewhere, but the prosecutor for that area didn't charge them because he took their word of their explanation, their narrative of this story. And Luz, you might be more familiar with this, but I think, aren't we like on the third prosecutor involved with that particular case because the other two end up having to recuse themselves for their relationship with the individual who actually pulled the trigger and shot Aubrey? But that speaks to the deeper, insidious kind of structural racism that we as community of color and American Indians have dealt with in this country since its creation. And the fact that, you know, we've seen television programs and movies and other depictions of cases where, you know, you can think back Emmett Till's and the courage that his mother took to display her son's body for the funeral. And these white men, exactly, right? I mean, admitted to killing this young. And the jury, the all-white jury in their jurisdiction, found them innocent. That talks to the deep-rooted systemic racism that we as communities of color deal with day in and day out. And the same thing would have happened here unless that video was released.
Yeah, and to think that in that case with the Emmett Till case, that they later, after the trial was over, admitted their guilt in an interview.
Exactly. Or the fact that the woman finally admitted before her deathbed that she lied about the whole thing in the first place.
I think once, you know, Americans declared racism is over, it has become so difficult for people to accept that there are still these racially charged incidents. And now that we're seeing them more and more due to social media and cell phone cameras, it's caused a rift in our society with people saying, and I hear this all the time, not everything is about race, right?
So let's talk about that, Halee. Let's talk about that, because with these shootings, there are always going to be folks who try to justify things. It's a yes and a both and situation. We know that in Colorado, there are people walking around with KKK hats in May of 2020 in grocery stores saying that they're wearing the Confederate hat as part of their masks, so to speak, which doesn't make any sense, but and that when they're called out on it by other consumers or the store owners, that their response is they didn't mean to offend anybody and there's no race issue involved. Similarly speaking, in Santee, California, KKK hats are being worn. Masks with swastikas are being worn also in Santee, California, during COVID. And they're saying the reason they're wearing the masks is to protect themselves, that there is no implication whatsoever that is racial in nature. We've also seen the hundreds of liberate protesters on the Capitol steps in Michigan with Confederate flags.
Can we also stop calling them protesters? They're not protesters. They're terrorists. Protesters don't show up with machine guns. And they're not liberating anybody, okay? These quote-unquote protesters who show up on the Capitol steps saying, I want a haircut, they're not fighting against something that is real, in my opinion, right? None of them are saying, I'm a hairdresser and I want to get back to cutting hair. They're all saying, I want my hairdresser to get back to work so they can cut my hair.
A certain voice is getting left out of this conversation, and that's those people whose businesses are on the brink of extinction, and they do want to get back to work, and they think they can do it safely, and they want to be trusted to engage in business, and they want to get back out there and serve the people who come to them for whatever service it is. But their voices are oftentimes left behind, and somebody who's getting all the attention is the person in front of the governor's mansion who is co-opting that whole side of the discussion to say, I want to get a haircut, which unfortunately dumbs down the entire debate. And it makes some people on the more liberal end of things say, well, see, well, we can't even work with these people, when that's not necessarily the truth.
There was a restaurant that opened up in Wisconsin, I think, and their statement, not their statement, but the statement they made to a fellow restaurateur was that we can't live off $200 a day of takeout. If we don't open now, we don't ever open again. And those sorts of statements, I think, garner more understanding from a wider public. But the sign they put on their door was, we're liberated now. If you don't want to come in, don't come in. And what you're saying is 100% true, Marianne, is there are a lot of small business owners, and I'm a small business owner. There are a lot of small business owners who have, a friend of mine has a salon and she's on Facebook. And so she says things like, we want to be safe and we understand, you know, you need your haircut and we want to get back to work because this is our livelihood, et cetera, et cetera. So your statement is made in those sorts of ways of like, we care for you. This is our livelihood. So we obviously want to get back to work, but we also care for you. It makes me less likely to be like, oh my God, right? Roll my eyes at them. It makes me less likely to do that versus people who are saying, open the state now. And those people are the loud people. And you're right. Those people are the people who are getting all the attention. And that's unfortunate because I want to say that the majority of small business owners want to be safe.
I think the bigger issue here is the responsibility of mainstream media to temper these images and temper the messages. So give us some aspect of it, but don't keep it 24/7, just replaying over and over and elevating the priority of that over what I would say more important journalism, which is to cover the stories of the Ahmaud Arbery's or the Breonna Taylors in our world, right? So again, going back to most recent examples, I should say, we don't know. There may be other cases out there where Black or Brown or Indigenous people have been killed in the last 2 months that we've not yet heard of, but that may come to line with social media. The point being is, where's mainstream's responsibility in terms of their media to cover these proactively and not wait until it goes viral on social media to elevate that? You know,
I agree with you 100% on that, Luz. I'd say the issue here, and if you want to talk about mass media, is that mass media is a business, and it'll come down to what story will take less time and generate more viewerships, more clicks. And that, unfortunately, is something that since we've moved online, many news organizations have a bottom line to hit, and they know they can send somebody to over where the protest is and get some great shots and video and quotes, and people are going to eat that up versus launching an investigation to figure out what's really going on with these cases, which will take thousands of hours of investigative journalism, which, you know, if many people say journalism doesn't pay, it doesn't pay the bills, unfortunately. So you have that reality also working its way into how newsrooms choose the stories they cover.
That's also a concern about, you know, with, like, my husband likes to watch 24-hour news networks. And I get really annoyed because I find that a lot of times there's one update and then there's a bunch of commentators, right, who just sit and speculate for the next 12 hours until we learn something new. I don't know if you guys have seen Anchorman 2. As ridiculous as it is a total, like, true commentary on 24-hour news.
It is. It's actually great. I am right with you on that one. This whole illusion of 24-hour news that, oh, so much is happening right now, when they're basically reiterating the same thing over and over and over again to lure you in. And, you know, for every person who's constantly on the air, that's one less person that's in the back room actually doing the journalism.
You know, Don, I saw you nodding earlier, and I was curious if what was going through your head was the same as mine. But as far as the fomentation of behaviors, and I'm asking you this as a teacher of comparative racial analysis, if this pattern historically, when things get hard in the country, we either expose or see increases of racial incidents with people of color. As folks are frustrated, it pulls out some of the worst of us. Does this pattern seem consistent with what you've seen historically?
That's a really interesting question, Anthony. There is a pattern, right? I mean, you know, when things get depressed, we see it in this country. When we go through economic downturns, that anger, the tension, the uncertainty, that energy has to be directed. And it's usually directed against a group that, you know, is prominent for one reason or another at that time. And, you know, so we talked about it earlier in one of our other episodes. We talked about how that tension, that racial tension, was being directed against Asians, i.e. Chinese people, but in this country, Asians is generally, and how that racial tension and that animosity was being used against members of that community. Our country, I think, is notorious for directing that type of racial animosity toward a group of individuals. But in terms of what we're seeing in this country, you know, it saddens me. And I also agree with Marianne and her analysis of how news, because I always get discouraged how it takes somebody's phone video to bring to light what actually happened in a situation where these stories go undetected because of systemic racism. And until these things show up, you know, they never rise to that level of attention. And when they do, or even after social media brings these to light, we still don't get these same coherent narratives on these stories across the board, if it's covered at all. You know what I mean? And so, you know, as you guys were talking about that, I'm thinking about when a story does break, it doesn't matter what channel or what news source you go to, the headline for that story is amazingly relatively the same in terms of the language, the words. I mean, my daughter's graduating this year, so we watched that high school graduation broadcast the other evening. Obama spoke at the end. And, you know, Obama made some general comments. And then the next day, the headlines that I read, Obama rips Trump's administration. Well, I didn't hear he ripped anybody, and he didn't name any administration, but that was the headline. And as I looked across different media platforms, the message was the same. Right? So somebody's making decisions somewhere during these times on what gets said, how it gets published, and how it gets carried, much to what Marianne was saying. And it's really sad in this country.
You bring forward a double standard that's part of our issue here. Just like under segregation, separate but equal, it's a fallacy. And we have that same situation here with the experiences of people of color, that the response to and the ways that things are reported are separate and unequal. And we've already litigated that and decided that as a country, that's not okay. And yet we still do it in our actions. You know, I was running with my son doing our 2.23 mile run in honor of Ahmaud. And first I had to recount why we were doing it in a way that kept the honor and memoriam of the run, while realizing that I also am in a situation of having to communicate to my son how to be, because he's in a transition, unfortunately, in a society who will start to apply manhood to him, and he's only 8, because he's a Black male. I had to start to recount not only what happened, but why it's important. And I watched him speed up and push me to have to speed up as we were running when we were in the memorial conversation. And then I watched the realization on his face as he started to internalize, wait, what happens to me? Then I had to explain to him, no, you're okay. You're with me and on all these other things, which I can't really promise, right? And then I found myself giving the same talk that I give when we go out and we go camp and we go outdoors, you know, what it's like to live in the wild, and that you can do your best to prevent a situation, but you have to be prepared when you get to that experience. And I couldn't find the words to tell him that no matter what he chooses in life, he could be in a situation where somebody's fomented fear of him could kill him. Or he could be the most successful person ever. You know, I'm talking about Barack Obama, right? And no matter what all your success is, somebody in power could say that you have the most corrupt administration, and it gets traction despite the facts being the complete opposite. That just the mere statement of that could end a career, in the same way that a scared white person could end your life. As we bring this to a close, I just need to do something active because I've worked myself up to being pissed at the world. So one of our team has recently won an award for being the kind of journalist that gives me hope. There you go, Luz. I can end on some hope. So I'm going to kick it over to you, Luz, to tell us a little bit about the award our very own Marianne Combs has won for the type of journalism that exposes and gets us to talk about the things that we don't like to talk about.
Marianne Combs, we are so proud of you with this award. You are the recipient of the Edward R. Murrow Award for your investigative work on innocence lost. You're reporting at the Children's Theater of Minnesota. We are extremely blessed to have you as part of the Counter Stories crew. We celebrate you and we honor you. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to turn around and just thank you guys, because I am a better journalist for these conversations. And the work that I do is so informed by the wisdom that you all share with me that I feel such gratitude to be in the room for these and to get to call you all my friends. So thank you.
Now, Marianne, I know that you have to take us to the news break and we're going to close the conversation portion of this week's episode. But again, Marianne, thank you. And I want to leave you folks with this saying. It's a saying that comes from my wife's grandmother, and that is, when America catches a cold, people of color catch the flu.
You're listening to Counter Stories on Minnesota Public Radio News, and we've been talking about the effect of COVID-19 in simply underscoring and in some ways amplifying the inequities that already exist in our communities. I'm Marianne Combs. I'm a producer and reporter for NPR News.
Anthony Galloway, senior partner at Dendros Group and executive director of Arts Us.
Clay Lee, owner of the Other Media Group.
Luz Maria Frias, founder and CEO of The Savvy Coach.
Don Eubanks, associate professor at Metropolitan State University and cultural consultant.
We've got more coming up, but first it's time for a break for this hour's news. And we're back. I'm Marianne Combs. Over the next few months, the hosts of Counter Stories will be interviewing people in some of Minnesota's most vulnerable communities to amplify their stories and their voices in a time of crisis. In this series, we'll look at the growing racial tensions spreading across the U.S. and how COVID-19 has dramatically changed their lives. We begin with Luz Maria Frias talking to a woman we've named Susan because her parents are unauthorized immigrants and she fears they could be deported. Susan was just a year old when her family came to the U.S.
She was lucky to get DACA status, or deferred action for childhood arrivals, giving her the legal right to remain in the United States. This simple act allowed her to graduate from university and enabled her to find full-time employment. Her father isn't so lucky. Despite petitioning U.S. Immigration Services over 20 years ago, he still remains one of Minnesota's unauthorized workers. We join the conversation as Susan talks about how her family hid the fact that they're unauthorized.
I always have known that I was an undocumented immigrant growing up. I was always very well aware of the immigration system and the way that it impacted my family. I was very much told and encouraged by my parents not to go around telling people where I was born in case that it would inspire people to put the dots together, especially during that time when I was growing up in the early 2000s. We were going through another uptick of anti-immigrant sentiment, just as we are now again. I was encouraged by my family not to do anything that would make people realize that I am an undocumented immigrant, because it wasn't until 2015 that I was able to apply for the deferred action for childhood arrivals and gain some sort of status. Luckily, that executive order came out for me at a time right before it would have been more obvious. For my brother, who's 2 years older, he was already 16 and older. So for him, he already had to start making those excuses for other people of why he doesn't have a license and why he doesn't have a side job at his age. But for me, it was more of a natural transition. So I didn't have that weight on my shoulders of having to explain to other people why I wasn't on the same trajectory that they were at that point.
When we talk about the stress, certainly you had to, all your childhood life and into your adulthood, had to straddle that stress of knowing that you were coming up in Minnesota and you were undocumented, and then your parents are undocumented, and now that you have status as a DACA recipient, but your parents still don't have status. We know across the country that these mixed status families, so you have DACA status in your family, you have a U.S. citizen in your family, and then you have undocumented parents. So tell me those dynamics. How does that impact how you as a family navigate every day, but then also coming into the complexities of having COVID-19?
Yeah, I think that for my parents and my brother and I, it's a lot more of being on the same wavelength, since my brother and I grew up being undocumented as well. And then DACA came around. It's not as huge of a difference from being undocumented in terms of how you feel, because you're very much still tied to the immigrant system and what immigration decides for you and your future. So I think that we are more so on the same wavelength versus my sister, who is the lone U.S. citizen, who I think has a more difficult time finding the balance in her life versus how much she can disclose and how much she can't disclose. So I think that she struggles a lot more with understanding the experience of being undocumented because she doesn't live that fear. But the fear that she does live with is the fear of everything completely being taken away from her because her parents are undocumented and her siblings also have an uncertain amount of time of safety with immigration. So I think our family dynamics are very interesting because it's kind of like we're on one side and my younger sister's on the other of trying to balance how much you tell people about your life. In terms of right now, it's an interesting situation because my parents are still undocumented. My brother and I both live away from our original family house now. So my sister is dealing with now we're having to be kind of homeschooled and working with that technology with only my parents being in the house. And my parents do speak English, but not very well. They went to school in Mexico, so they're not up to speed on the curriculum that my sister is currently going through. So it's an interesting dynamic that they're now having to figure out. And my sister doesn't have the full parental support in terms of the how do you log into Google or how do you do a video call? Like my parents have no way of helping her with that. So it's been an interesting dynamic at home. And then as far as all of us, my brother and me, and then my parents, we're kind of setting up our own mutual aid network amongst ourselves and trying to figure out how to best support our parents as people who have Social Security numbers, who have received stimulus checks. We're having to redistribute that within our own family. So it's definitely something that probably is a very unique experience versus what U.S. citizens are going through right now.
When you talk about mutual aid in your family, let's unpack that a little bit. Both of your parents have been in the workforce for quite some time. So let's start with your mom.
Yeah, so my mom has been working in a non-essential sector for a little over a year now. So once the COVID-19 pandemic became more of a reality, her workplace didn't really do anything differently. And then when Governor Waltz put out the order that all non-essential businesses would not be opening anymore, the place that she works for was very quick to come up with letters on why they are an essential business currently. So they gave out letters to all the employees, and their justification was that in order to continue keeping the economy going, they were essential employees. So my mom was categorized as an essential employee. So during that time, she was still going to work, but was facing a lot of high anxiety. She had a lot of fear of being in an enclosed space with other people in a setting where social distancing is not as much of a possibility. Also being in a space where a lot of the things that the materials that they're working with are being touched by multiple hands. And face masks were not something that were prioritized. They were not given out. If anything, the bosses were more so just encouraging their employees to source their own face masks and own protective equipment and bring that to work. Things like hand sanitizer also were not widely made available. So really the changes that were happening at her place of work weren't a lot. Recently, in the past 2 weeks, she's actually been furloughed along with a lot of other employees. So it kind of came to light that the business that she works for was not really caring about being essential. They were just caring about getting their last batch of production out and then furloughing all of their employees. So right now my mom is lucky enough to be furloughed. Once her job production ramps up, she'll be able to go back to her job, but she's not able to apply for unemployment as an undocumented immigrant, and she's also not eligible for a stimulus fund check. So she's kind of just living life as if she were fired in any normal capacity. So for other people right now, if they're laid off of work or furloughed, they have the opportunity to continue receiving income from the government in a supplemental way to continue their way of life. But people like my parents are not eligible for the aid. In a way, what my parents and other undocumented immigrants are going through is pretty much normal for us. It's a very normal reality for undocumented immigrants to not have the certainty of a job and also not have any supplemental aid from the government when they do lose jobs. But I know that it is very hurtful for my mom that she is suffering through this pandemic just like everyone else, but she's not able to get any sort of aid to help my family through that.
I'm sorry to hear that your mother was furloughed and the added financial stress on your family, which in addition to what you pointed out, what I want to highlight is that she pays taxes as someone who, when she's employed, she's paying into Social Security, she's paying into federal and state taxes, but yet, as you said, she's not eligible for any type of relief. Let's shift to your dad.
Yeah, so my father also works in a sector that is non-essential at this point during a pandemic. And pretty much all of his coworkers are also in the same immigration status as he is. So these are folks who don't have reliable health insurance, who don't have reliable ways of supplementing their income if they are fired. These are people who have to go to work because they have to feed their families, or they have to feed themselves, or they have to keep up payments for the apartment, or even having to keep up payments to pay off the people that brought them here to this country. A lot of people go into debt for paying the people who help them make the journey from their home country to this country. So these are people who cannot afford in any way to stop working. And their job is very labor intensive, and they are working with a lot of other people in close proximity. Luckily, my father has been working this job for over 20 years and has developed a relationship with his boss that has allowed him to advocate for at least cloth masks for his coworkers and himself. But the ability to social distance and to really keep a healthy environment in this sector is not really there. So my dad goes to work with this fear of if there was an outbreak at his job, it would cost a lot of people their livelihoods and it would affect a lot of families. So it's a very precarious situation to be in, but I think that my father, along with a lot of other undocumented immigrants, this isn't something that is a complete change in his life. So my father and a lot of other undocumented immigrants, they are used to working in a sector that doesn't value their safety, that doesn't value their families or value their humanity, and in a sector where undocumented immigrants are very severely underpaid and exploited for their boss to make more profit off of their business and their labor. So for my dad, I don't see a huge difference in the amount of fear that he has, or at least he's covering it up very well because he knows that there is no other choice for him. He can't be engulfed by fear because he has to pay his mortgage. He has to pay the car insurance. He has to pay for the internet for my sister to be able to continue to enhance her education during these times. There is no other option for him, and I think he's very aware of that, as other undocumented immigrants are. So even if there is a risk at work, it's almost like it's the same amount of risk that they've been facing this entire time, even before the pandemic.
So if he were to get sick with COVID-19, what would that look like in your family in terms of access to healthcare and treatment and any safety nets that you might have or be eligible for?
Yeah, if anyone in my family were to get sick with COVID-19, especially if my father were to get sick with COVID-19, everything would fall apart. And again, I want to emphasize that this risk and this fear of my dad even just losing his job has always been present, even before COVID-19. He has always been the main source of income for our family. And we always knew that if my dad were to get sick, or God forbid, have his leg broken or something else that would keep him away from his job, things would fall apart very, very quickly. A lot of things are tied to him, and there isn't any way for us to apply for unemployment or apply for aid from any source.
I know this has all been difficult, just sharing as much as you have regarding your family. And when we look at the undocumented community, I think most people would be surprised to hear that the undocumented community is very philanthropic. And I want to say in a very non-traditional way, but they are constantly sharing their limited funds and wealth in so many different ways. Can you help us understand that and give us examples of what you have lived through from that point of view?
I can name so many different instances where we have attended food sales, or we've participated in buying raffle tickets, all of which have been organized by families or small community groups in order to benefit a person's funeral, or someone who needs help paying for their hospital treatment. So there's constant community effort to create and build up on funds to help other people in the undocumented community. I think there is a sense of obligation because we all know that if something were to happen to us, the only thing that we have to rely upon is our community that surrounds us. So I think that that commitment to each other is really what continues to help us through difficult times, even through what we are facing right now with COVID-19. I'm really proud to see so many community organizations building up on mutual aid funds specifically for communities that are most vulnerable. And it definitely continues the tradition that immigrants, refugees, undocumented immigrants have built in order to protect each other and to keep each other alive in a place and within a system that doesn't really provide any safety net for any of us.
We're nearing the end of our time together, Susan, and I can't help but to think about maybe you might have a message or two that you want to put out there for policymakers at the state and federal level about what you would like to see different in terms of our laws, in terms of our initiatives, in terms of the response to COVID.
I think there's so much I would say, but in terms of the response to COVID-19 and keeping residents safe and nurtured during this time, I think that it's really a shame that undocumented immigrants and folks who are also in between statuses right now, that they are left out of these stimulus packages, or they're left out of the unemployment funds, or they're left out of even the small business grants, because there are so many members of our communities that do run small businesses. And right now they're struggling even more than usual. And I think that that is kind of the main message, is that undocumented immigrants, our community has always had fear and has always lived with uncertainty. So this pandemic isn't something completely new for us. It's kind of just another layer of oppression, another layer of fear, another layer of control, another layer of instability and uncertainty for our future that just builds upon all of the other things that we deal with in our lives as being undocumented immigrants, as being people of color, or being Black people, or being Indigenous people, or being working class people. So I think that that needs to be acknowledged, and it needs to be recognized through being a part of these funds that the government is putting out, because undocumented immigrants, whether they are acknowledged through paper or not, are the ones that are helping sustain our economies. So when we talk about reopening the economy, we need to include the narrative of undocumented immigrants. We need to include the narrative of folks who are in between statuses, people who are completely and in every way contributing to the economy, contributing to the community, and are consistently left out of bills, consistently left out of the stimulus package or unemployment. My message really would be that just because we are not being officially recognized does not mean that we still aren't here. Because even if people aren't getting stimulus packages, they're still going to work because they have to. So whether you like it or not, you're taking advantage of people and not giving them anything in return and not supplementing their income during a pandemic, which is truly a moral issue, but also an issue of exploitation. Our communities give so much and consistently are not having that giving reciprocated. So I really think that it's not an issue of if immigrants, undocumented immigrants, are eligible for funds. It should be a question of, are we going to pay back people all of the work, the taxes that they are paying into the system that keeps the economy, that keeps the schools running, that keeps fast food places open, keeps Target open, the vegetables on your table, the farms? Because I think that we are questioned for eligibility in these packages, but we contribute everything that everyone else contributes. We just aren't acknowledged for it.
Thank you so much, Susan, for your insight and your courage in coming forward and sharing your journey with us. I speak on behalf of Counterstories and our crew here. We wish you the very best. We are so proud of your contributions to Minnesota, and we hope that you stay healthy and safe along with your family, and wish you the very, very best. Thank you for everything.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Counterstories with Luz Maria Frias, Don Eubanks, Anthony Galloway, and Halil Lee. I'm Marianne Combs.